KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, a rebroadcast of our interview with cult filmmaker James Gunn, who was hired by Warner Brothers to write and direct a video game. Then two indie filmmakers make a documentary about the idiosyncratic creators of indie video games. But first, a brand spankin' new Hollywood news banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times in Telluride, Colorado. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
John, what are you doing in Telluride, Colorado?
I'd love to say I'm out bike riding and hiking, but I'm watching movies. We're in the middle of the fall film festival season, so I am in Telluride for the Telluride Festival. Luckier people might be in Venice for the Venice Film Festival, and starting September 6th, we have the Toronto International Film Festival.
And of course, these are the places where we start to get a look at some of these anticipated awards contenders, and in some cases, notably Telluride, we're just about film and we're not in that game so much, but still some of the awards contenders are in Telluride as well.
Yeah, I would put at the top of the list Ben Affleck's Argo. He both directed and stars in this film. Set in 1980 about a very creative CIA rescue of six American hostages who are hiding out in a Canadian embassy. Let's just say that Hollywood saves the day. And I think once we head into Toronto, there are probably a lot more films there that have awards aspirations, although Toronto cuts a kind of broad swath. They are scheduling movies not only like Argo and like The Master, Paul Thomas Anderson's movie about a cult leader who has a striking resemblance to L. Ron Hubbard, and Terrence Malick's new movie, To the Wonder, but Toronto also plays very mainstream movies like Hotel Transylvania and Finding Nemo 3D. So it's almost as much of a press junket as it is an awards gathering.
Well, we'll be hearing more about that in upcoming shows as it gets underway. Meanwhile, I know, John, that you're saddened because it appears that Jersey Shore, the show that saved MTV when it was spinning into total irrelevance, is reaching the end of its run.
Yeah, six seasons, and I have yet to watch a single episode, so I feel very proud, although I have seen some clips here and there.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, so this was an important thing, and there was a time when Jersey Shore was, in its fourth season, as recently as that, 8.8 million viewers at the beginning of that season, which is a record for MTV. And they tried to broaden it out. They sent them to Italy, Florence, Italy, to spice things up a little bit, but eventually viewers just sort of stopped watching as much. And, in some ways it's not that much fun anymore. Mike, the Situation Sorrentino, is now living with a sober coach and dealing with his addiction to prescription drugs, and that doesn't seem that fun.
No, and I think the economics of the show also caught up with it. Obviously, it's run its course, but the prominent, what do we call them, performers, individuals, cast members, they were earning more than $2 million a week, and I think that was an unsustainable economic model.
We do have a spinoff, Snooki, who is now a mom, has a show, Snooki and JWoww, so if you really need a Jersey Shore-type fix, there will be that for you.
I'm going to look for parenting advice from that show.
Now, meanwhile, there's a new study. A lot of money is spent, as you said, to pay the talent on such programming. But the money that is spent, this study raises questions. It shows that a striking number of people never even see really expensive ads that are aimed at them.
No, this is a study done by a company called Simulmedia, and it was using data from Nielsen and Kantar Media. And I have to say, this was pretty astonishing. And the basic finding was that people don't remember ads. They don't have any impact. And in the United States, this is a massive business. U.S. companies, the study found, are going to allocate more than 40% of their total advertising spending, $64 billion, on television ads. And the study said it was, in many ways, money poorly spent because it made no impact.
The study said only 20% of the viewers even saw the ads. So I assume they're skipping them one way or another. One example that was given, it was an ad for Axe deodorant, which hit a very small percentage of the people that it was meant to hit. But there's a quote from an ad executive at Interpublic's Universal McCann, a big agency, and, you know, the clients include Coca-Cola and MasterCard and companies like that. And he's saying there's not a lot of impetus to make change, but he adds, I'm fairly certain that whether we like it or not, the horse is out of the stable. And the horse may be out of the stable. I'm just not sure where advertisers go, because television is still, you know, especially broadcast, that's the big tent. It's the aggregator of eyeballs. So where else are they going to go with their money? The internet has not proven to be that potent of an alternative.
Well, I think they're going to stick with TV, and I think they're going to focus more and more on sports, where ads are not skipped. And I think that's why we saw this massive deal that ESPN made last week for baseball. So your sports is going to get a lot more advertising, and that advertising time is going to get a lot more expensive.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. And you can banter about Hollywood news anytime on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. Coming up later in the show, two very independent filmmakers have an excellent adventure with their first feature documentary. But first, filmmaker James Gunn on writing and directing a video game. Today, we're rebroadcasting a couple of interviews that come at the world of video games from two very different angles. First up, Lollipop Chainsaw. It's a video game that came out earlier this summer and has since sold over 700,000 units. The heroine of the game is a buxom cheerleader named Juliet Starling, who fights zombies with a chainsaw and the help of her boyfriend's severed head. It sounds gruesome, but it's kitschy, too, with rainbows and sparkles along with guts and gore.
Like, oh my God, you will not believe the kind of day I'm having. So I get to school, only everyone's a zombie. But not because they had to sit through calculus. I mean, they're all zombie zombies.
One of the creative minds behind this game is James Gunn, a maker of cult horror movies like Tromeo and Juliet, Slither, and Super. He also wrote the screenplay for Dawn of the Dead and the Scooby-Doo movies. But last year he got a call from Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment with an invitation to do something completely different.
And they call me in and they have me come in and I have to sign a bunch of non-disclosure agreements. In filmmaking, you generally don't sign non-disclosure agreements. Like, I guess people just kind of trust you not
they
to steal their ideas.
They don't have that super secret Scooby-Doo plot.
Yes, exactly. They don't have you sign non-disclosure agreements. So I had to sign all these non-disclosure agreements, which made it kind of cool and secret and stealthy for me. And then I went in and I sat down at this table and they showed me this footage of what was a girl, high school cheerleader, the character that was going to become Juliet Starling in the game, with a chainsaw, cutting up zombies. And as she was cutting up zombies, there's like blood coming out along with a mixture of colorful rainbows and pink sparkly hearts. It's what I say a lot is like a combination of Dawn of the Dead and the Powerpuff Girls. And I really just freaked out on the aesthetic of it. I loved it. And honestly, I was also sort of touched by the fact that Warner Brothers and the Japanese people that were making the game Grasshopper came to me, because I have a very specific aesthetic and that's it. And I love the combination of mixing the profane and the innocent and putting them together in a way that people haven't seen before. I'm a fan of a lot of artists like this, a lot of films like this. And I said, what do you want me to do? Whatever you want me to do, I'm in.
So how does it work? They say, well, we want you to do a video game.
Yes.
And we want you to be, I mean, how many notes do you get before you start?
None.
Okay. No.
They say, here's what we have. So they had some of the things were starting to be built in the game. Some of like the locations, some of the characters were designed, are partially designed. And then some of the basic thought of a plot was there with the game. And they said, we have this game. Suda 51 is the name of the guy who was the original game designer. He's a Japanese guy. He's kind of like
his name is what?
Suda 51.
That's a name.
His real name is Goichi Suda.
Okay.
And Suda is like the rock star of Japanese gaming. He's created all these cult games that have very low sales here in the States, but people love them. And they wanted somebody to help them make a game that was more appealing to Westerners, that helped take, you know, Suda's vision to the next level. And that's what they came to me for originally.
So when you say they gave you characters that were partially designed, is that like just visually? Or
visually.
Do they actually say, this is a girl and this is her backstory?
No, visually. I mean, yeah, there was some backstory. Like I knew in the game, Juliet Starling is part of a, you know, a family of people who fight supernatural beings.
Okay.
But even that part is like my spin on what was originally there. But she had sisters. She has a father. They're in the game. And that's a part of the overall story. So I had little bits and pieces to play with. And then I had to fit in a story and dialogue and really flesh out real characters that had, you know, desires and personalities and things like that around what already existed.
And then do you communicate with
Suda 51? Yeah. Yes. We had these crazy conferences. We had them all the time, like twice a week, where I would come in and it would be me and the two Warner Brothers guys sitting around a table. And then we'd have a big video screen on the wall. And it's like eight Japanese guys and then their translator sitting around a table. And unlike, you know, you go to Germany and basically most Germans speak English. It's
right.
Very easy. Japanese people don't generally speak English. And so trying to communicate with them about these specific story points and simultaneously trying to learn how you work together in a way, because there is a different approach to, you know, Japanese business than there is to American business. And that is all at play, you know. I mean, to be completely honest, my personality isn't perfect. And one of the things I have problems with in business anyways, I'm kind of just blunt. So dealing, I just would sit around that table and I would hear myself talking and I'm like, I know I'm coming off like this brash,
American,
jerky American. Yeah.
Right.
But in the end, I love those guys. We have a lot of respect for each other. Suda's the greatest guy, and especially when they came over and we started working together in person.
So what is the role of Suda at that point?
Suda is the overseer of everything, basically, and then a lot of the creative stuff was left up to me and the Grasshopper team of guys at that point. So it was initially Suda's idea.
Now, you're credited as,
you know, writer, consultant, different things. I also directed all of the actors.
So I don't want to be personal, but
sure.
Do they offer you a piece of something like this to work on it?
Yeah, yeah. I get a small piece and then I get paid a fee, you
yeah.
know, which is nice, you know, is a nice fee.
What about budget, though? Is there a budget freedom that, I mean, do they tell you this is your budget and you just used it up?
Well, first of all, the budgets are bigger than movies.
Now, get out.
Well, I mean, okay, not bigger.
Which movies?
Listen, some of them are as big as the, you know, there are $200 million games in the same way there are $200 million movies. But the average budget of the average game is larger than the average budget of the average movie.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with filmmaker James Gunn, whose latest project is a video game, Lollipop Chainsaw. Writing the script gave him a chance to use his skills in a whole new way.
You know, a regular screenplay is 100 pages. The script for this thing is like 1,000 and something pages.
Holy moly.
Because, like, let's say you'll have the character of Juliet who's saving someone from a zombie in the corner of the room. And it's a college student. And she maybe saves the character and the character runs away and yells something as the character runs away. Or she's unable to save the character and the character dies. Now, you write 30 lines of dialogue for the character when the character runs away, okay? Like, oh, thank you so much for saving me, or oh my gosh, I'm happy to have a second chance on life, or whatever. But you want it to change because game players play games again and again.
Oh, so it has to be different. Okay.
Many different options, right? So it's a randomization.
Right.
And then you have like 30 other lines of dialogue for if she dies. So like you're having to write just so much. And unlike in a screenplay, you don't have to be a perfectionist about everything because it is really something that a player will hear once and then they're going to hear something else. So for me, it was an incredibly creatively freeing experience. And I just was able to get into this flow of writing where I'm writing and writing and writing and writing and making myself laugh a lot because I'm writing nonsense that I probably would have never come up with if I wasn't writing so much.
At this point, this is going to come out soon, your game.
Yeah, it comes out on June 12th.
I mean, I don't know whether they do stuff like they do with a movie where they...
Oh, yeah. I mean, already there's, you know, we have TV commercials and all sorts of stuff. In fact, its marketing budget is probably five times that of any movie I've done since Scooby-Doo. So,
well,
yeah.
Scooby-Doo probably had a pretty hefty little marketing budget.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're talking...
Tens of millions.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they spend a lot of money, and already they've spent a lot of money there. You know, they have a big presence in magazines and comics, and, you know, we have a Lollipop Chainsaw bus that travels to all the conventions. We have a girl who plays Juliet, who goes around the country playing Juliet.
So now you've done it, and where does it leave you? Do you want to be the Lollipop Chainsaw guy for the next iterations? I assume they do iterations.
If the game does well, there will be a Lollipop Chainsaw 2. And yeah, I would definitely love to be involved, and that would be great. You know, and I would like to do more video games. I found it to be a really fun thing to do. So I'm talking to Warner Brothers about other games we could do together. And I love film.
Like on the Funometer.
On the Funometer, it's more fun.
How does it compare with movies?
On the Funometer, for me right now, it's more fun. I've been making movies for a long time and I'm very particular about it. And I found it a little bit freeing. And I also think that it's sort of an exciting time to be involved with. I mean, the language of gameplay is not finished. It's an art form. I believe it's an art form, despite what Roger Ebert says. And, you know, it hasn't even gone into its golden age yet. And so I find that really exciting to be a part of a medium that's in the process of being created and isn't yet what it's going to be.
James Gunn is the writer of Dawn of the Dead and the director of films like Super and Slither. He's now written a video game, Lollipop Chainsaw. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a blast.
And now, from big studio-produced video games to the world of independent games. Yes, the video game business has a whole culture of independently made games, where teams that may consist of only one or two people work without big budgets or mass marketing campaigns. Their labors are the subject of the new documentary film, Indie Game. Indie Game is available for digital download on multiple platforms, and that's how the filmmakers wanted to distribute it. Lisanne Pajot and James Swirsky took the do-it-yourself approach from the start. Back in May 2010, they turned to the then little-known crowdsourcing website Kickstarter to fund their film.
We had very modest goals. We set up a campaign for $15,000 for us to basically get in a car and drive around North America to start shooting this film.
$15,000 is not a lot of money for a documentary. It's not a lot of money for any type of film.
But
we were kind of using it in the real spirit, or how Kickstarter started. We were actually using it to kickstart and thinking that we'd augment it with more funds down the line.
This must have been fairly early days for Kickstarter even. I don't know how long they've been around.
It was, yeah.
I think they were out 6 months prior to us, or 8 months.
Yeah.
And so we went and we shot a piece with Edmund McMillan, who created Super Meat Boy, who ends up being a sort of a feature character in the film.
Meat Boy, for people like me, is a game.
Meat Boy is a game. And so, so we shot this piece with him and we put it up on Kickstarter. It was like a vertical slice of what we hoped the film to be. And then we, you know, pressed send and we waited to see what the internet would say. And they really liked it.
So we were asking for like $15,000, and we thought it would take about 30 days to get it, and we ended up getting it in 48 hours.
Wow. Did you up the thing?
No. The way it works is people can keep giving. So we ended up at $23,000, which was, again, in the film world, is a very modest goal to make a film. But to us, it was life-changing.
Yeah. It was basically this big, overwhelming yes.
Do you know who your people were?
We got to know them over the past 2 years because we've been talking to them every day. And that's sort of what's different about
this
project.
You like email back and forth or literally talk the old-fashioned way?
Twitter and Facebook. People email us every day. You know, that initial campaign, I think, ended up at like 400 people. And now our audience is like, I don't know, 10,000 or so of people that have been following the campaign and pre-ordered in some sort of way.
Coming up after a short break, the indie game filmmakers get into Sundance and won't sell their movie. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. Thank you.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're rebroadcasting our interview with the filmmakers behind the documentary Indie Game. The movie introduces us to the people who come up with independent video games like Super Meat Boy, Fez, and Blow, which are often born from personal stories.
Even though it's a game that people are supposed to buy, it's not a game that I made for people. I made it for myself. You know, Ed and I made it as a reflection of ourselves, and we tried to make it as fun and as accessible as possible. Whatever. If people want to buy Modern Warfare or Halo Reach, that's fine, because I think those games are shit.
The filmmakers behind Indie Game, Lisanne Pageot and James Swirsky, are two Canadians who run a company that makes short videos for corporations. Indie Game is their first feature film, and when it came to financing it, they took some tips from the Indie Game developers who were the subjects of their doc.
We treated the movie in many ways like an independent game. And so we were like two people using very accessible technology to kind of make this thing that, you know, we were really passionate about. And we were filming teams of one or two people just using their computers from Best Buy to make games that then they would release out to the world that they were equally passionate about. So we kind of like took a lot of their funding tips and tricks and kind of their marketing tips and tricks and kind of poured that into the movie. And we treated it a lot like an independent game.
So at some point you decide that maybe this could play at Sundance. But how did that come about?
We had been shooting the film. We put out like 88 minutes of extras content while we were shooting it.
You put out extras before there was a movie.
Exactly.
Okay. I mean, I guess, is that a way to just kind of engage and try to pre-build an audience?
Grow an audience for Completely. A film made by two people from Winnipeg.
Okay.
That was the idea.
Yeah, the whole thing was like from day one, just kind of engage the audience and kind of build it slowly so that once you do release, you're kind of hitting the ground running.
Right.
And based on all those extras, people started saying, you know, you should probably submit to a festival. And we hadn't actually thought of that.
Were you amazed that you got in, or were you like, yeah, we're pretty good, we should get in?
No, totally amazed.
Yeah, at no point did, like, you know, you don't start a movie and then like write down in your distribution plan or your strategy at any moment like, oh, premiere at Sundance. You never, like, that never happened. Even when we submitted, we just kind of planned to not get in because that's the pragmatic, prudent thing to do. And yeah, and then when it happened, we got a call. We were at a Starbucks in California, and it happened much in the way that you hear it described by other filmmakers, where basically we're sitting around, we got a call, they tell us the great news, and then all of a sudden you find yourself crying. So we were like these two people sobbing in a Starbucks. It looked like we were a couple that were breaking up. We were both terribly sad about it. And it
That's
just, yeah, it just made no sense. It,
like, you know, we made this film on our own, just the two of us. And then all of a sudden, there was just like this flood. We literally got 1,000 emails in a day.
Just when it's announced.
When it was announced that we were in. And it just turned into this thing. Like, it was this whole world of Hollywood and sales and people and distributors and stuff that we weren't familiar with at all. And so we just waded through all that. We didn't know which emails to disregard or which ones to answer to. So we answered them all. Which is cool. And we had to Google a lot of people because we had no idea who anybody was. You know, we had visions of how we wanted to release the movie because we had all these supporters and all these sales and all these pre-sales. And so we had to sort of balance that as we were talking to people and sorting it all out.
So did you pick a rep by the time you got there?
Yeah, we worked with Andrew Hurwitz, a film sales company in New York. So we had a rep and we found out that we needed a rep. At first, we didn't want one, but then we realized we needed one.
Because it's confusing to sort through who's offering what and who do you want to be with?
Yeah,
kind of. And also, like, we don't know, like, we think we know what a good deal looks like, but we really don't have that good, a handle on it. So it's just everything is new to us and we needed to know kind of what is good and what is bad.
But at the same time, we had a very specific idea of how we wanted it released digitally. And Andrew really respected that. And so that's why we chose him.
Was there ever a theatrical plan that was more, I mean, I'm not sure actually what the plan is, so maybe you should just tell me that.
Yeah, so we went to Sundance and we were like, okay, let's hear what everybody has to say. And some people wanted theatrical and digital, which seems to be tied together, and VOD and all these other, you know, different rights that we learned about. And in the end, we decided not to sell it. And it sounds bizarre.
Yes.
Because people seem to go to
that's
Sundance
why they
to,
go, yes.
to sell things. Uh-huh. It was agonizing. It was like a hard decision. Like, are we really screwing up here? Mm-hmm. Should we take these deals and go make something else? But instead, we really wanted to see it through. So after Sundance, we decided within like 5 days that we were going to do a tour. We brought on Adobe, the big software company, to work with us. And we did a 15-city tour that showed the film to almost 10,000 people. We booked it ourselves. From the success of that tour, we ended up booking our own theatrical in the States, playing in like 7 markets. Mm-hmm. We did like a full thing in Canada, a one-day-only event with Cineplex. And this is all stuff that we brokered ourselves and with the help of Andrew. We didn't end up working with anybody, mainly because our big sort of focus was we knew that this film would do really well online.
And did you have to talk Andrew off the ledge when you told him you weren't going to sell it? Did he
cry? He was a little annoyed, but not really. Like, he knew what he was getting into.
I think he kind of, like, took us on saying, like, okay, yeah, you guys have this idea, but as soon as there's a deal in front of you, you'll take it. And then we said no to it.
To a number.
And he was like,
yeah.
Oh, you're serious
really serious
about this digital thing. But he's been absolutely awesome.
Okay, so somewhere along the line, you know, there are a lot of wolves in Sundance looking to make deals, and they've been at it for a long time. But one of the biggest wolves, and I mean that in a complimentary as well as a, you know, less complimentary way, is Scott Rudin, who appears somewhere in the saga to make a deal with you guys.
Yeah, a few weeks before Sundance, I guess someone in his office saw the trailer and they contacted us directly and said, you know, we'd love to talk about your movie. And it was very bizarre because it was a very bizarre email to have an email just say, Scott Rudin wants to talk to you, period.
we thought it was fake.
Did you?
Well, no, like we thought
we
this
get a lot
can't
of
be
email.
Real. Or it's maybe just another Scott Rudin.
Right.
You know,
Yeah. So Scott Rudin and HBO have optioned the premise of the film to potentially make into a dramatic TV series.
You guys must have just thought, damn, we are on fire here.
Well, we also agonized about that because we had never thought about remaking the film into a TV series. And that was like a first thing. Oh, this happens now? That was sort of a thing. But then it was just like, oh, if this would ever happen, who else would we want to make it?
Well, yes.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, it's Scott Rudin. It's HBO. It's like, I want to see that show. Like, as a person who watches stuff on television, I want to see that show happen. And it's just dream partners. And surreal.
But do you get to be involved?
Yeah. That's part of the deal.
Okay, so, tell us how that works a little bit. I mean, what do you get to do?
Well, in theory, we get to be consulting producers on it. So you tell me what that means. So
we'll talk in a while. Well, so what's next for you guys? Do you want to do another doc?
We learned so much making this one, like just in the filmmaking. We just wanted to do the next one better. Mm-hmm. And because we just learned so much, we'd never made a story that's like 96 minutes long before.
Well, would you go back to the Kickstarter model? Do you feel like you really are wedded to that because you like the independence? Or would you ever go out and say, okay, I'm going to try and raise financing the old-fashioned way?
No, I would definitely go back to Kickstarter. Not so much just because of the money, which obviously is fantastic and great, but it's just for the audience interaction and engagement that it provides, you know, from day one, like right at the start, you know, to actually form that community and have like the most passionate people right at the very beginning and kind of grow with you is a really, really powerful tool. Like this movie is doing kind of really amazing things that we never thought it would. And we haven't spent any money in marketing. You know, we sold out the tour using Twitter and Facebook and that's it. And, you know, building mailing lists and all that stuff. And just we've been able to talk directly with our audience, like, right from the start, and we'd want to do that with whatever we do next.
James Swirsky and Lisanne Pageot are the writers, directors, and producers of the new documentary Indie Game. And thank you guys so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.